south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
You want to hear one of my pet peeves? I got a lot of them, but there's one that just keeps wearing on me. That's when people say, Google it. Sometimes you hear that multiple times a day. Google it. God, I hate Google. By the way, when I had my very first Expat Insider Seminar, 10 years ago now, one of the attendees was one of the top Google guys. I think he told me his employee number was 9 or 10. You know, in the tech industry, that's how many employees identify themselves to others, by their employee number. Who would have thunk, huh? Low numbers are golden. That's a badge of honor. Heavy bragging rights in a hip tech company or startup that can supercharge the social life of a snaggletooth nerd who just last month was living with his mom. Yep, especially in Silicon Valley. You know, it's Silicon Valley, not Silicone. Silicon Valley would be Hollywood and the adjacent burbs. Anyway, a low employee number at a hot tech firm supercharges a nerd's social life, and you end up being invited to all kinds of exclusive events and parties they wouldn't have let you been a waiter or a bartender at just a couple of months earlier. Yep, if you're a very low employee number at an exploding tech firm, you're automatically invited into the supermodel dating club, too. Yeah, I know a few previously scruffy nerds who are in that club now. I mean, look at Elon. If he hadn't created all those tech businesses, how successful do you think he'd have been with women? I mean, did you ever see what he looked like when he was an unknown nerd before he got his teeth fixed and his hair transplants and improved his hygiene? Yeah, he had that Franciscan monk look. Check it out. Do a search. Notice I didn't say a Google search. Ugh. And Elon, that name, what were his parents thinking? If he was from my old neighborhood, he'd have got his ass kicked daily. In the current vernacular, he would have been every bully's bitch. And they named him Elon on top of that last name Musk, as in Musk Oil. A double name game whammy. Poor kid, huh? If he wasn't such a genius, he'd have surely been a Suicide Hotline season ticket holder. But fate had other plans for Elon. How many kids does he have now, and with how many women? That stuff just does not happen in the normal world of nerds glued to their cubicles. But we were talking about how much I hate Google. Let me count the ways. Oh, did you ever wonder how Google manages to generate yearly revenue of over $180 billion? For comparison, that's greater than the combined GDP of many Latin countries. Well, let me give you the quick rundown. Now, this is something only one in maybe 1,000 people know. And after you hear this, if it doesn't scare the hell out of you, well, then you deserve it when Google sells off your data to the highest bidder. It all goes back to the black magic of that Google search box, where all of humanity goes and tells Google what it wants, whether it's a Nikon 300 camera, an online nursing degree, divorced lawyer in Atlanta. Then, of course, on the right side of the page, Google invites you to click on the relevant ads specifically tailored for you. And Google's cash register rings every time you click. When that happens, the Google ad department simply holds an auction for marketing bidders for every search query entered. And that happens at the very moment the click or query occurs. The net result is that billions of times a day, Google runs an auction of keywords and phrases. And companies who want to link their ads to your keywords put in bids for them. So by looking at the bid and estimating the likelihood of a click, Google takes the product of the two, which is how much it'll make per query, and picks the highest one. So Google picks the advertiser that'll pay them the most per click. Next, they close the deal with the advertiser. Then Google displays the associated ad that the advertiser has created and uploaded to Google for that keyword or phrase. So you might ask, how many such queries or keywords are there? And remember, the ones that are most likely to be repeated are the ones that are most valuable to advertisers. Well, Google has a keyword list of over 500,000 words ready to sell to merchants and search engine marketers. And the current price and dollar value of each keyword is constantly adjusted according to bids coming in by the minute. Now, of course, there are not only keywords, but key phrases. And when you count the key phrases, there are millions listed in the Google sales department. And the value of a keyword phrase depends a lot on how the words are organized. For example, here are three keyword phrases that mean the same thing, but have a completely different dollar value to Google and the advertisers. Let's take the phrase you type into the Google search. Divorce lawyers in Reno. Cost per click, according to Google, $1.45. Then there's a second phrase with the same intent. This time it's Nevada cheap divorce. That is valued by Google at 75 cents per click. Then there's this slightly different phrase with the same intent, Nevada divorce lawyer. That's valued at $5.55 a click. So there's three phrases that mean exactly the same thing, but one is worth 75 cents a click and another one, $5.55. So why is that? Well, Google search engine marketers curate and trim that keyword phrase according to the best and worst performing keywords. And if the revenue generated by click sales outpaces the cost of the ad, up goes the bid in the budget, and the reverse is true for the opposite. With Google Ads, the ratio of revenue to cost is known as return on advertising spend, RAOS. For example, for the key phrase, Nevada cheap divorce. If you punch that into the Google search engine, Google Stats Show, for every dollar you put into Google to buy that keyword or phrase, you get $1.47 back. That's an ever-changing number depending on the click data. So that's how Google makes money. Oh, and here's something you might find really interesting. You want to know which is the most expensive Google keyword in the English language? It's always changing, but here's one of the top ones. Mesothelioma. I know. What the f***? Well, a mesothelioma is a rare form of lung disease, common among asbestos plant workers. And thanks to a series of class action lawsuits against former factory owners filed by plaintiffs' attorneys in 2011 who make fortunes on contingency fees, the value of this word in Google searches was then bid up by attorneys who wanted to get in on that action to $90 a click. So if you're a kind of dark-hearted person, like I can be sometimes, and you want to screw a scumbag lawyer, just Google the word mesothelioma and start randomly clicking on the ads that appear on the right side. What you're doing is costing the lawyer that posted those ads $90 every time you click. Good to know. That should be in the little black book of how to scam jerks and a-holes. Now, of course, the word mesothelioma is not a common word, and people who deal with it, doctors and lawyers, are in a pretty small niche market. But what about high-volume keywords? What are the most common? Well, in the top 10 of Google's real moneymakers come the words insurance, loans, mortgage, credit, lawyer, and dating. But by far, the two most profitable keywords for Google are insurance and loans. So, unfortunately, Google is the final gatekeeper for any internet business today. And everybody knows if you don't pay your bouncer or gatekeeper well, he'll give out free drinks and favors to his buddies and the riffraff. And what about those pop-up windows that always appear on the right side, promising to get your product or website in the Google top 5? That's another twisted scam. Millions have been sucked into that one. Problem is, imagine if 300 businesses pay a service or an outfit to get in the top 5 of Google rankings. Well, you get the point, right? Bottom line, I hate Google and all my searches are done through other search engines and websites, like DuckDuckGo, Start Page, and done through using the Brave browser. You know about the Brave browser, right? B-R-A-V-E? I hope you do. It's got automatic ad blockers, and it tells you when you first fire it up how many ads and trackers it's blocked, as well as the bandwidth it saved you and the time it saved you by not having to look through and load up all those pop-up windows. In fact, I'm looking at mine now. It says, in the last 6 months, it's blocked 540,356 trackers and ads, saving me 7.5 hours of time I would have normally wasted had those ads popped up and I had to unclick them to get them out of my face. So my advice, don't use Google, Yahoo, or any of the other usual suspect search engines. Download the Brave browser. It's free, and you'll really notice a huge difference. Again, I make nothing by telling you this, but since we're all mostly on the same page, and we all have a certain disdain for tracking, monitoring, and Big Brother, I figure by passing on this kind of information, I'm doing my part to throw a wrench into the works. How about you? What have you done lately to stick it to Big Tech and Big Brother? All right, moving on. Now, from the crazy stuff you kind of just stumble on department. The other day, I was sitting in one of my favorite outdoor cafe people-watching spots. It's one of my pastimes, people-watching. I know, it's not much fun up where you live, but down here in Latin America, man, sometimes it's like being transported to another planet. Anyway, suddenly, I spotted two very tall, Scandinavian-looking girls, each toting one of those gigantic backpacks that looks like you could stuff a dead body in it. And so these two 6-foot-something girls sat down at the table right next to me, took them about 10 minutes to get their backpacks off and settled in the corner. And sure enough, they were sort of professional backpackers that had been trekking through Latin America for the past 2 or 3 months. Now, the table was very close to mine, so I turned to the lady and said, "I don't know how you guys can do it, how you can carry those things around with you everywhere you go." And she said in her Northern European-accented English, "You get used to it. Besides, it's all we need to be self-sufficient." She said they had a stove, tent, water purifier, the usual stuff, etc., etc., plus some very unique, kind of high-tech backpacking gadgets. And that's when I noticed a long, kind of green fluorescent object that looked like a shoe stuffed into one of the compartments in her backpack. I said, "Is that thing a drone?" And she laughed and said, "No, it's a deuce." "A deuce?" I said. "Like the Beach Boys song Little Deuce Coop?" She didn't know what I was talking about. That was way before her time. Then she pulled it out and handed it to me. I inspected it, but I was stumped. I said, "What is it?" She said, "Guess." Obviously, it was an essential backpacking tool or she wouldn't have packed it. So I took it and read the stenciled lettering. It said, "Number 1 UUL Trowel, made in Colorado." I thought, oh, that's it. It's a high-tech aluminum mini shovel. I guess for putting out campfires and digging holes for tent stakes and such. And she laughed and said, "Guess again." She handed me her smartphone with the Amazon page for the deuce queued up. And after about 3 seconds, I dropped the thing on the table. Amazon called it the Ultralight Backpacking Potty Trowel. What the f***? Turns out it was a $30 poop hole digger. Perfect for poop hole countries, right? But 30 bucks? Come on. Made with, it said on the site, AMS-4045 aircraft and NASA grade aluminium, as the Brits pronounce it. I thought if it's good enough to dig poop holes on Mars, might it not be a little overkill for backpackers? Oh, and on Amazon it also says this about it. It's anodized in fun colors to prevent corrosion and surface damage, preventing dark smudges from bare aluminum on your hands. Way too much information there, don't you think? And it says this, I'm not kidding. Go ahead, have some fun. Pick a color like you would pick a color of a lollipop. Yeah, right, that's a good mental image. Oh, and then there's the Amazon consumer questions about the product. First question, just how big of a turd can you bury with this thing? Answer, a very large one. It's a good trowel, you've got it covered. Even if you've recently visited a cheesecake factory. Oh no, bet you think I'm making this up, right? I'm not. Oh, and for people who are absolutely full of it, you'll be glad to know that the deuce comes in 3 different sizes. Small, medium, and American. Wow, who'd have thunk? Yep, the hidden joys of backpacking. Though you gotta hand it to them, they picked the right name. The deuce. Oh, and of course, they've got an Amazon return policy and money-back guarantee. I guess I gotta think that one through. Oh, and you did know Amazon sells used and refurbished products, right? Which makes the deuce, reason 1,226, why I could never be a backpacker. Oh, and by the way, if you look up the deuce on Amazon, you'll find they have a very helpful instruction video. Have a look and try not to laugh. So anyway, in the end, after that backpacking lady showed me her equipment, well, when they got up to leave and one of them grabbed the deuce off the table, coincidentally, a waitress walked by with a big slab of cheesecake. Enough said about that. Moving on. Now, of course, you've heard me mention in the last couple of shows about the two guys on a motorcycle snatch and grab problem. Well, the fact is, us gringos and expats hate motorcycles in general because they break all the rules. And they've been getting away with it for years, for decades. Now, a funny thing just happened on the law enforcement front regarding motorcyclists who are breaking the law. Turns out on May 1st, just a little over a month ago, the city municipality of Quito, Ecuador, now that's a pretty decent sized city of around 3 million. Well, they decided to do something that's never been done before in Latin America. They decided to see what would happen if they told all the transit cops to enforce every single rule of the road for motorcyclists. Now, of course, all the transit authorities here in Latin America have the same book of rules that they have up in Detroit, Cleveland, Montreal, all the first world cities. And one of those hard and fast rules is that motorcyclists cannot weave between cars to get to the front of an intersection during a red light so they can be the first off when it turns green. That's always been an illegal maneuver everywhere in the world. And it's on the books in all cities here in Latin America too, but it's never been enforced until now, or I should say May 1st, as a test case in the city of Quito, Ecuador. So what happened in that month? Well, to say the least, the motorcyclists are all pissed off. The new ordinance in 1 month has resulted in more than 1,000 fines and the confiscation of over 200 motorcycles. and that weaving between car thing has garnered most of those fines. In fact, on Monday, May 31st, a month after the rules were actively enforced by the transit cops, hundreds of pissed off motorcyclists gathered to block traffic routes during rush hour in Quito. To which I say, tough. In a TV news interview at the time, one of the protest leaders said, quote, "It's illogical for motorcycles to wait in traffic lanes like cars and trucks. They should be allowed to maneuver between stalled lanes to prevent additional congestion," he said. Oh, boo-hoo. Where's my reparations? That was me, not him. Anyway, he went on to say, "If we wait and queue up like the cars, the traffic problems will be even worse." Then the guy named Jorge Callejo, spokesperson for the Legion Bikers, one of the protest groups, he said, and this is unbelievable, quote, "All us motorcyclists are asking for is respect and the right to drive safely through the city. We demand," he said, "respect and repeal of Rule 284. Say what? Man, that guy's got a tapeworm for a brain. Actually using the word respect? When not a single moto driver gives a hot damn about anyone else on the road? You gotta see it to believe it, but those guys are nothing but animals. That said, in response, the transit authorities completely disagree, citing sky-high motorcycle accident rates. The facts say it all, says Quito City Councilman Andrea Hildego, who says, based on years of collected data, that there are 400% more accidents involving motorcycles than individual cars and trucks, saying motorcyclists do not deserve any special privileges, being that they've proven over and over again they are a serious hazard to drivers, pedestrians, and property, adding that it's not only the invasion of personal space between traffic lanes and cars causing the problem, but that in the case of traffic jams, many, many motorcyclists drive on sidewalks, across parking lots, green areas, even the wrong way down one-way streets, endangering pedestrians and destroying property along the way. Often driving the wrong way down a one-way street, endangering people for their convenience, showing little concern for others. And it's interesting to note that Ecuador's transit cops have data that shows about half of all motorcycles in Ecuador are unregistered, and more than half of the registered motorcycles have expired license plates. That's the reason, a transit cop spokesperson says, more than 200 bikes have been confiscated in 1 month. And suddenly, it's not just the police and city officials who are supporting the crackdown on motorcycles. Car, truck, and motorcycle insurance companies are admitting that motorcyclists have become a menace on the roads, with the insurance industry saying, quote, "Our members support the respectful operation of motorcycles, which includes abiding by all laws," adding, "Our streets are being invaded by a lawless element, many with unregistered and illegal bikes, and this should never be allowed." Then there's Traffic Superintendent Jose Rodriguez, who says the number of accidents is exploding, with most of them the fault of motorcyclists. And even when the police arrive at the scene of an accident and there's no motorcycle to be seen, more than half the time the driver of the wrecked truck or vehicle reports there was a motorcycle involved. Though when a motorcycle's involved in an accident and the bike is not heavily damaged, most often they'll just leave the scene. And of course, pedestrians are endangered too. In fact, this year, 3 pedestrians have been killed by motorcycles so far, with about 50 more people hurt enough to end up in the hospital. Add that to the fact that Ecuador's National Traffic Agency, ANT, have stated publicly that most motorcyclists have at least one piece of faulty equipment or ignore the use of mandatory safety equipment altogether. The law says motorcyclists must wear helmets, gloves, and knee and elbow pads too. That seems odd, but the agency says most motorcyclists don't take that stuff seriously. And why not? Because up to now, there's been no enforcement. Worse yet, consider the fact the number of motorcycles on the road keeps growing by close to 30% a year. All right, meet Johnny with my 2 cents. Well, first off, I can't believe a Latin city is actually enforcing those laws. That's a miracle in itself. The thing is, though, there's lots of excitement and talk about it in the press, but I've seen necessary crackdowns peter out before. For example, in Guatemala some years back, a law was passed requiring all motorcyclists to wear a fluorescent vest with their license plate number stenciled on it. When it was announced, they had a month to get on board. Well, they all did, because the cops set up roadblocks and fined bikers who didn't have those vests. Now, flash forward about a year. Well, enforcement dropped off the map, and little by little, those vests just started disappearing. So then what'll happen with this test case in Ecuador? I'd say there's about a 50-50 chance of making this thing work permanently. It's about the money. And when governments are broke and they can fine 1,000 people a month, it doesn't take long for government slugs to figure out it's a steady source of income. And though according to you and I, that might seem like the wrong reason, well, any reason's a good reason to get those retards and morons off the road. All right, now another boots on the ground story out of Guatemala from one of my Expat Insider Seminar attendees who's decided to come back and live in Guatemala permanently. He's been here around 4 or 5 months now. Amongst other things, he'll be talking about the step-by-step process of starting a new business in Guatemala. All right, here goes. He says, Johnny, Joe Cano checking in. Well, it happened. I finally am starting a business here in Guatemala. I put it off as long as I could, but the universe kept screaming at me with all the business opportunities I'm seeing. I got sick of thinking about it, so I picked one. I'll fill you in on that once things get a little farther along, but I'm very excited about it. Though I admit, it's like you say, Johnny, once you're down here for just a little bit, you can't stop all the business ideas from flooding into your head. Now, a slight digression, Johnny. Once I explain to people that I moved here from California, I get asked the same question. Why Guatemala? I always give them the same answer. I like the weather. I like the people. I like the business opportunities. Then they nod. They understand the first two, of course. Why not? The weather is perfect and the people are great. It's that last reason that without fail puts a very confused look on their faces. Really? They ask. Well, I guess you have to be down here to see it for yourself. Now, about starting a business. The ideas are constantly slapping you in the face, so that's the easy part. But what about the paperwork? Well, that's easy too, I found out. I just called up my trusted Latin lawyer, and by the next afternoon, I had my own company, two bank accounts, and a nice glass of whiskey. It was that easy. This country works like things used to do in the U.S. Now, it is quite a bit about having the right lawyer, too. So I went down with my lawyer to the premium branch at one of the local banks. We got ushered into a private conference room. A banker came in to attend our needs. Paperwork was done, and we were out in less than an hour. So, you want to start a business in Guatemala? Just phone up your favorite attorney, and you'll need him for other things, too. Speaking of attorneys, Johnny, because of all this COVIDiot BS, sometimes you just can't walk into places or hotels without an appointment or being a guest there, etc. It can be a bit irritating. Enter the Gringo Advantage. You can't believe how easy it is to get into places just because I'm a gringo. And the magic words, I have a meeting with my attorney. Well, the doors just fly open because, of course, it must be important. Another gringo starting a business obviously has positive repercussions. Jobs for the locals, etc., etc. And believe it or not, Johnny, I've even gotten cops to move traffic barriers and cones during rush hour using that important meeting with my attorney bit. It's handy, all right, and it suits my style. I like to push boundaries. On that note, I have another quick gringo traffic story. I have to admit, for the first few months living in Guatemala and driving here, I would get pulled over a lot. That or get stopped at one of the show me your paperwork checkpoints. I wouldn't be speeding or driving crazy or anything. It would just be a bunch of cops looking for someone to get a bribe out of. Knowing I'm off the tourist trail and almost no one speaks English, I just pull my fast surfer English routine from California and go about my business. Well, one night I was pulled over while driving home and the cop was not buying my usual spiel. This time he had me step out of my car. I was irritated, but I complied. And that's when I heard his partner say, in Spanish of course, he's CIA. All right, me Johnny here throwing my two bits in. You know, Latinos know all about the CIA. They've heard a million stories and seen a million Hollywood movies. But they don't call it the CIA. They pronounce those three letters as a whole word. They say CIA. Él es CIA. They don't say C-E-A, CIA in Spanish. Which is kind of strange because they don't run the letters together with FBI. They don't say FIBI. They say F-A-B-I. But I don't get a lot of things. Oh well. So anyway, Joe says they said he's CIA, CIA. They said to one another, we won't mess with him. Well, my ears perked up and I decided I would not do anything to dissuade them of that thought. So I went on the offensive and started harshly questioning the cops in English about why I was being stopped and why my time was being wasted. Well, the guys took a step back and with wide eyes motioned for me to go ahead and just leave. I did, thinking I may have taken it too far. Though, I haven't been pulled over or stopped at any checkpoint since. I don't know if it's connected, but I went from getting stopped consistently to not getting stopped at all. I ask you, where up in the States could you get away with that? I suppose, though, could be the cops have seen some CIA people because they got a huge U.S. embassy here. That said, Johnny, I'd like to finish off with a little cryptocurrency talk. I was listening to your podcast a while ago, and you were talking about bitcoins and shitcoins. I'd just like to say not all other coins are shitcoins. Some shitcoins do exist, a decent amount, in fact, but there are some actual practical good ones that will be a large part of everyday life in the future. All right, me, Johnny, here. Yeah, he's talking about DeFi. That's the decentralized finance system that's coming on board fast, and that's powered by mostly Ethereum and Cardano. So Joe's right. Some so-called shitcoins do have utility, staking, yield farming, etc., and you can make and lose a ton of money. The thing is, you have to really study that stuff. You have to be on it all the time. Whereas I'm just an old-school advocate of buying and holding. So I'm with you there, Joe, but you have to remember, all financial markets are set up so the house wins. 90% of people lose and 10% win. However, in crypto, if you just buy and hold, in time, you almost always win, and big. But during big dumps, it can be nerve-wracking and a nail-biter. But history has proven if you just buy and hold, you can't help but have fantastic returns, as long as you're not investing in stupid meme coins. Sure, you can get in and out and make a ton of money, but you gotta know when to get out, and almost none of us knows where the top is. So that's why I stick with sort of the top 5 coins on the coin market cap list, because they'll be around a long time. All right, then Joe says, that's why people need to talk to Captain Mango about this stuff. I know I say this every time I write you an email, but it's so true. He'll hold your hand and guide you through into this big, beautiful new crypto world. He'll get you all in. I only have been in crypto myself just about a year, and I've made 44 times my initial investment. Even financial professionals who make their money in the stock market don't make those kind of returns in their entire lives. It's almost embarrassing how much money I've made in crypto, he says. The truth is, I've done so well, I don't even have to work another day in my life if I don't want to, and I'm only in my mid-30s. That's not me bragging now, that's just me wanting to tell people they really should try to get into this. Crypto is about to become the greatest transfer of wealth in human history, and there's still plenty of time to get in. Anyway, that's it for today, Johnny. Never a dull moment down here, unless, of course, you planned it that way. Signed, Joe Kano. All right, Joe, thanks for that. And you're 100% right about Captain Mango. There's a lot of guys out there on the internet and YouTubes and such teaching people about crypto, but you just can't go wrong with Captain Mango. He's been in crypto at least 8 years now. Whereas 95% of all those guys on the net and YouTubers trying to teach you stuff, they're newbies in for 2 or 3 years. They've only seen a few ups and downs. Well, as for Captain Mango, he's an old seasoned crypto guy. That's the kind of guy you want to learn from. South
of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.